Welcome to the Nation Magazine Podcasts. You're listening to Nation Conversations, exclusive audio of Nation forums, events, seminars, and salons.
I'm Betsy Reed, executive editor of The Nation, and I'm here with Jeremy Scahill, who's written a story for this week's issue of The Nation called The Dangerous U.S. Game in Yemen, at a moment when the U.S. is engaged in a very public war in Libya. Jeremy's written a piece that gives a history of a much less public, in fact, a covert war in Yemen. Can you tell us how long this has been going on and, you know, leading up to this, you know, current moment in Yemen when we're seeing a lot of upheaval, like as is occurring in the rest of the Arab world?
The covert U.S. war in Yemen really began right after 9/11. The president of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, has been in power in Yemen since the 1970s. He's ruled a unified Yemen since the 90s, and he's an incredibly wily character. I interviewed a lot of former intelligence and special forces people that had worked with him, including one guy, Colonel Pat Lang, who actually used to go hunting with Saleh. And he was a guy who managed to navigate the Cold War and deep tribal divisions. And so when 9/11 happened and he saw the swift dismantling of the Taliban government, Saleh decided that he wanted to take the side of the United States as a survivor. So he flew to Washington in November and essentially had a series of low-profile meetings with the top echelons of U.S. military and intelligence community, and then some very public meetings with President Bush, where he declared himself an ally in the war on terror. And what the United States essentially did with Saleh in 2001 was say, we'll give you an aid package and we'll start training your military forces if you allow us to come into your country to take down al-Qaeda operatives. So essentially the Bush administration started this covert war under the guise of training Yemeni military forces. In 2002, the U.S. bombed Yemen in a drone strike and killed six people, including a U.S. citizen named Kamal Darwish. And that was the first known strike that the U.S. conducted off of the declared battlefield of Afghanistan. And that really kicked off what would be a sustained decade of covert U.S. operations inside of Yemen. The Obama administration really escalated that war, began to increase the military funding to Saleh's government, increase the training of Saleh's most elite forces under the guise of fighting the newest, most popular branch of al-Qaeda, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And so really from day one, John Brennan, the top counterterrorism advisor, and the president himself, Obama, have been all about covert operations in Yemen. The current situation is that the president of Yemen, Saleh, has shown pretty extreme violence against largely nonviolent protests. In fact, the day before the bombing of Libya started, Saleh's forces shot dead more than 50 nonviolent demonstrators in the capital, Sana'a, including many that were shot by snipers to the head. And the Obama administration, far from the kind of response that they offered when Libya was killing protesters, actually said, we want a political solution in Yemen. And the Defense Secretary Robert Gates said it's not the U.S. business to comment on the internal affairs in Yemen. So very, very different responses to Yemen, because he allows the United States to shoot people in the head, and therefore he's allowed to shoot people in the head, to Libya, where everyone hates Muammar Gaddafi and want to see him go. So it's a classic case of the U.S. double standard, but it's also a very dangerous game the U.S. is playing there.
How would you say the U.S. policy toward Yemen and specifically the counterterrorism operations have contributed to the instability there?
Well, in December of 2009, President Obama authorized two airstrikes combined with joint on-the-ground raids involving the U.S. Special Operations Forces and Yemeni forces that resulted in a tremendous number of civilians being killed. And these strikes were initially reported as a Yemeni operation with no U.S. involvement. But then it became very clear once the bombs that were used, the missiles that were used in the strikes, were examined by journalists and human rights organizations, that the type of munitions used in these attacks, the kinds of Tomahawk cruise missiles with cluster bombs, that they were in fact U.S. weapons. And what we now know, because of the release of secret U.S. diplomatic cables by WikiLeaks, is that the entire thing was a U.S. operation. and that General David Petraeus and the president of Yemen, Saleh, conspired to lie about Yemen, about the U.S. role in this. And in fact, the deputy prime minister of Yemen says in one of those cables that he just lied to the Yemeni parliament by saying that it was a Yemeni operation. Those operations or those bombings, when innocent people were killed, when civilians were killed, in a country that is largely governed by tribes, not government, really caused an uproar against Saleh's government. And those were two of a half a dozen or so strikes that the Obama administration authorized at the end of 2009, beginning of 2010. Perhaps the most devastating was when one of these targeted assassination plots that the U.S. launched in Yemen actually killed a member of the Yemeni government who was one of the top mediators with al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. That caused a massive uprising against the military installations of Saleh's government in the tribal area where these strikes took place. So they've had a destabilizing impact because they've confirmed what al-Qaeda has long said, and that is that Saleh is a puppet of the United States, that he allows the United States to bomb, and that when civilians are killed, he puts the blame on the Yemeni government rather than the United States. But also, and I think in a way this might be more important, the U.S. has created a situation or an arrangement with Saleh where they have rewarded him for crying al-Qaeda and saying, well, we've got this big al-Qaeda threat in our country, and they always give him more and more money. In fact, one senior counterterrorism official that I interviewed who's worked for more than 10 years on Yemen issues for the United States government said that al-Qaeda is the gift for the Yemeni president that keeps on giving. The Saudis and the U.S. will keep giving him money as long as he says al-Qaeda is a threat.
Well, I just wonder, I mean, Saleh is regarded by the U.S. as a very pliant partner in its global war on terror, as you write in the piece. But in reality, he, as you say, he's been a very wily player and, in fact, hasn't necessarily regarded al-Qaeda as the chief
right.
threat to his own power.
I mean, this to me is one of the most rich parts of this story. I mean, Saleh was a guy who managed to emerge pretty much unscathed from the Cold War. And he, almost like sort of Marshal Tito in Yugoslavia, was able to balance things between the Soviet Union and the United States. And not many countries were able to do that without taking a side, particularly in volatile regions. So with regard to the way he's handled the United States, the United States has rewarded him for saying al-Qaeda is a big threat, so give me money, give me helicopters, train my units. But then he's regularly turned around and used U.S. funding, U.S. weapons, U.S. very elite training to go after his domestic political opponents, the Houthis in the north of the country, which is a tiny minority sect of Shiite Islam in Yemen. Ironically, Saleh is himself a Zaydi Shiite. And then there's a southern secessionist movement. So to put it in sort of blunt terms, he's pliant in the sense that he'll allow the United States to come in and bump people off, as long as they're not bumping off people that he wants to stay alive. But on the other hand, he's also a double dealer because he'll take this training and weaponry that is only supposed to be used for going after al-Qaeda and will actually use it to kill off his own political opponent. So yes, he's pliant. On the other hand, he's a total backstabber, double dealer, and an extremely crafty character.
So what do you think is likely to happen next?
Well, I mean, I said when all of this started that, and I'm not a Yemen expert in the sense that I've spent a career working on this, but I have spent a large part of the past year talking to people whose entire life has been spent professionally working on Yemen and the intelligence and military community, and they were really saying, don't underestimate Ali Abdullah Saleh's ability to stay in power. So, you know, I was saying a couple weeks ago, you know, don't underestimate his ability to sort of ride this out for a period. Everyone, though, that I'm talking to said he's finished. It's just a matter of how many clicks he has left on the clock. His presidential term was supposed to expire in 2013. He had said months ago he wasn't going to seek re-election or pass power on to his son. The opposition movement, which now has among its ranks very senior military people, including the commander of the 1st Armored Division in Yemen, the most powerful military figure in the country. Diplomats have been resigning over the past week. Tribes have been pulling out the rug from under Saleh. So it does seem as though his days are numbered. The question is how bloody it's going to be before the end is declared. If he were to use his U.S.-trained counterterrorism unit against demonstrators or against the insurrection, it could become extremely bloody. This is the most well-trained force in Yemen because it's received U.S. training for a decade. So the wild cards here really just boil down to how much time is he willing to hang on and how bloody is he willing to let it get.
There's also a question for the Obama administration about whether or not they can continue the level of military support and training and the presence there, you know, in the face of such obvious human rights abuses.
Right. I mean, remember, the beginning shortly after 9/11, the U.S. worked with Yemen to establish what they called a counterterrorism camp in Yemen. And hundreds of U.S. special operations forces and CIA people have gone in and out of Yemen. Many of them are classified as trainers. Some of them are trainers. Some of them are there under that guise, and their purpose is actually to go and do what are called kinetic operations, direct targeted killing. If the government that comes after Saleh or the transitional figures that emerge as the power brokers in the country are less pliant than he is or don't want to play ball with the United States, that could call into question a whole array of U.S. operations there. The intelligence gathering, the training operations, the targeted killing operations. So there have been some indications in recent weeks from the intelligence community that there's a plan underfoot to move, to shift the center of the covert operations in Yemen in terms of its planning capability over to Djibouti in Africa, which is the head of the center of AFRICOM, the lead command now for the U.S. in going after Libya. And for, you know, for a decade, the U.S. has had a covert base inside of Djibouti, Camp Le Meunier, which used to be a French military installation. So it could be that they have to pull everybody out and move them over there until they see what happens. People that I've talked to in the intelligence community say that the U.S. does not have a very good handle on who makes up the Yemeni military or good connections with any of these people. In Yemen, tribes are the most important thing. As Colonel Pat Lang told me, Saleh's old hunting partner, neither AQAP nor the United States are going to determine the future of Yemen. It's going to be the tribes. So it seems like the United States is going to have to really seriously evaluate whether it's even safe to keep its special ops people and spies on the ground in Yemen in the way they've been there the past 10 years.
One striking aspect of your piece is the way you chronicle the development of this very significant U.S. military strategy to defeat al-Qaeda in Yemen, while also chronicling the growth of al-Qaeda in Yemen. So do you think that this could be an occasion to reevaluate the entire approach?
Right. Well, one thing that's really interesting is that, you know, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is far more media savvy in a way than the old school al-Qaeda guys, bin Laden and Zawahiri and others. You know, they've started a magazine called Inspire, which is a glossy magazine. I'm waiting for Arianna Huffington to buy it and figure out how to monetize it. But they've developed this magazine, and the new issue just came out this week, and it shows computer screen with reboot in progress in Yemen, meaning that Saleh's time is over, it's time to reboot. And they're sort of celebrating the quote-unquote Arab Spring, the al-Qaeda operatives. And, you know, they have a number of English-speaking individuals who are able to communicate with Muslims in Western countries. We probably, as a nation, wouldn't have paid much attention to Anwar al-Awlaki, the American-born Yemeni cleric, if he didn't speak English. He's mid-level management in AQAP, in al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, but the U.S. has blown his reputation up so much because he speaks in English, and we have the power of nightmares here. We're afraid of boo now when it comes to terrorism. So the power of AQAP, and we're probably talking about 300 to 600 people in terms of core operators, has been to scare Americans. They really haven't been successful in carrying out any spectacular attacks. They had the Undi bomber, and that failed, but it succeeded in the sense it scared the hell out of people. They had the parcel bomb plot, where they had these explosive materials smuggled in printer cartridges. That didn't succeed, but they succeeded in scaring a lot of people. And then you had the hoopla about Nidal Hassan, the army major who was alleged to have shot up a number of other army personnel at Fort Hood, Texas. So they really bank on the power of nightmares. And I think the Obama administration's response to AQAP has been to go after them with a hammer when what probably was called for was more of a scalpel approach. And I think they're making them more powerful than they should be.
Yeah, and also, I mean, as it's proven true in Egypt and other places, they thrive under the most repressive, anti-democratic environment. So, you know, that obviously raises questions about U.S. strategic policy in the region.
Right. I mean, like Joshua Faust said, who was one of the people I interviewed for my piece, who very recently left the Defense Intelligence Agency as a Yemen analyst, you know, he said that the U.S. spends almost no time figuring out how to drain the swamp,
right,
taking away their sort of reason for being. And yeah, I mean, these guys will thrive in any kind of a lawless environment. That's why you see Al-Qaeda's presence expanding in the Horn of Africa, in Somalia. It's not that there's something inherent in you know, Somalis that makes them want to, you know, join Al-Qaeda. It's the fact that you have this kind of lawless, ungoverned, chaotic civil war situation.
But also with
where
a
they
very
thrive.
Repressive,
of course.
Corrupt state.
Right. I mean, and Saleh, I mean, for instance, has used Al-Qaeda against his domestic opponents the same way he's used the U.S. training and weapons. I mean, if there's one thing that sort of has unified Al-Qaeda and the United States in Yemen, it's been Ali Abdullah Saleh, the president there. And yeah, the other thing about repression is that when you have so many people, as has been the case in Yemen, that are thrown into these gulags, these prisons for years on suspicion of having been affiliated with Al-Qaeda or being falsely accused, and you're tortured in those prisons, that's all used as a recruitment drive. So you have that combined with this, you know, really fearful response on the part of the U.S. population and the government to these attempts to bring down airlines. All of that combined with Saleh's repressive nature or any of these other dictatorships make it fertile ground for Al-Qaeda recruiting. That's why you see so many Saudis. One of the reasons you see so many Saudis joining Al-Qaeda and going over to Yemen is because the House of Saud is viewed as this epically corrupt monarchy that has disgraced the holy lands of Mecca and Medina. So your point is a very good one. I mean, repressive governments are very fertile ground for growing terrorism because they have legitimate beef. And ordinary folks say, well, actually, what they're saying is right. Because my uncle was arrested or abducted, or so-and-so was shot, or this cousin of mine was told that they had to pay a bribe. You know, you combine the corruption then with somebody saying, hey, let's get rid of these people. And that's why you see a lot more support for these folks.
One last question. We're hearing a lot about this so-called Obama doctrine emerging from his speech the other night. What do you see as, you know, embodied by the Yemen experience as, what does that reveal about the Obama doctrine?
You know, I don't think that Obama actually has a doctrine. I think he's taken some of the worst aspects of the foreign policy under the Clinton administration, combined them with some of the worst aspects of foreign policy under the Bush administration. So if there's any doctrine there, it's to double down on really bad U.S. policy. In the case of Yemen, President Obama has expanded the targeted killing campaign and has reinforced the idea that the world is a battlefield, which was a neocon pipe dream, and has made it U.S. policy that if we want to go into another country and assassinate someone, including one of our own citizens, we can do that. If we want to send covert troops into the Philippines or into Somalia or Ethiopia, Eritrea, Kenya, any of the 75 places in the world where U.S. Special Ops forces are now, that it's fair game. So I would say that what Obama has done is to take what many people, particularly on the left, thought was a set of policies unique to Bush and has solidified them as bipartisan foreign policy in the United States. And I think that's a really disturbing and sobering thing to sort of realize is this is going to be with us for a very long time.
Thank you, Jeremy. Please read The Dangerous U.S. Game in Yemen in The Nation magazine.
Thank you.
Nation Conversations is a product of The Nation magazine and is available on iTunes. You can hear more podcasts at thenation.com/audio. Thanks for listening.